My name's David Harvey, and I'm director of the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics, hosting this event. And this is a time of celebration for the publication of a book by Mahmoud Mamdani on Define and Rule, Native as Political Identity. I'm not going to go too long because we're starting a little late and we should get to the cut to the chase, as it were. Professor Mamdani is a Herbert Lehman Professor of Government at Columbia University, and he's also Executive Director of Makerere Institute of Social Research in Makerere University, Kampala, Uganda. He's the author of many books, which I must say, a rather splendid group of them. Citizen and Subject was the one that first came to my attention. It's a fabulous book if you've never read it, and there have been several more ever since, including Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, America, the Cold War, and the Roots of Terror, and then Saviors and Survivors, Darfur, Politics, and the War on Terror. And the way we're going to proceed is Professor Mamdani is going to talk for maybe 30, 40 minutes about the new book and some of the ideas presented in it. And then we'll call upon Ali Jamal Ahmed, who is a professor and chair of the Department of Comparative Literature at Queens College in the City University of New York, who will make some comments on it and then engage in a conversation with Professor Mamdani, and then after that we will open it to the audience. So without further ado, let me welcome Professor Mahmoud Mamdani. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I apologize for being late. It was between the driver's inability to find exactly where I was and my inability to communicate to him exactly where he could find me. But here I am. I'm delighted to be here. I don't think I've ever given a lecture on a set of lectures, because this book is a set of three lectures, which I gave a few years ago, the W.E.B. Du Bois lectures at the Department of African and African American Studies at Harvard. When I was giving the talk, I was trying to understand the big shift in British colonial policy, which heralded a shift in generally Western colonial policy, I thought. I also thought that this big shift suggested that a move away from a common citizenship to the recognition of difference in the political domain was basically a move that took place in the colonies. And I thought this move began really as a response to a deep fundamental crisis of British colonial rule, marked by two events, the 1857 uprising in India, and Morant Bay in the 1860s in Jamaica. Um, and then followed up some decades later by the Mahdiya in Sudan. The official British explanation of 1857 was that was to point the finger at unreason amongst the colonized, that over 90% of native soldiers in the British Indian Army had revolted because these Hindus and Muslims, their prejudice had been aroused by a rumor that the bullet, it was greased with the fat of the pig and the cow. So the former outraged the Muslims and the latter outraged Hindus. When this explanation was presented in the British Parliament, a member of the opposition stood up and asked, how come this didn't prevent them from using the same bullets to shoot at us? So the explanation was not bought in Britain, nor, of course, was it really bought in most circles in India. British scholars began a sustained and determined search into what had gone wrong. Why 1857? Why had the natives rejected the civilizing mission? Amongst the leading British thinkers, at least the one who came up with a response that held sway was the legal anthropologist Sir Henry Maine. Henry Maine was a member of the Law Commission of the Viceroy of India after 1857. And Maine pointed the finger at English utilitarians and evangelists. Maine said the fault was theirs. They were mistaken to think that India was like a blank slate and you could write the civilizing mission on it as you would on a blank slate. They were mistaken to think that natives had no agency and that actually the only way forward would be to understand the agency of the native and to understand the history which had forged or through which that agency had been forged. And Maine wrote a series of books, the best known of which is Ancient Law, but a number of others, which set about the task of understanding this history and this agency. Now, Maine was not the only one, in a sense. He was among a number of thinkers in Europe at that time, middle of the 19th century, who sought to distinguish the West from the rest of the world. There was Ferdinand de Tonnies, who distinguished between Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft, community and society. There was Emil Durkheim and his distinction between mechanical and organic solidarity. Unlike these two, who were looking at the historical development of Western society itself, and trying to understand what was it that cut off what they thought of as the past from the future or from the present, tradition from modernity, Mayne was interested in the difference between the West and the rest. Most of the times he called the rest the East. And he thought the difference lay really in a binary, in a conceptual binary of civil law and custom. Of law which is able to abstract itself from culture and is therefore transportable over space, which can be the carrier of a civilizing mission, and law which is still so embedded in culture, which has failed to emancipate itself from culture, that it's spatially fixed. He called it custom. Mayne thought that only the West, which had gone through the experience of the Roman Empire, had managed this feat. This feat which emancipated reason from culture. And in his book, he is constrained to explain why Aryan groups, those who spoke a body, you know, this Indo-Germanic languages, why some of them had not managed this feat, such as India and Ireland. And his answer was basically that they hadn't gone through Roman Empire. The problem in these places was that they tended to idealize law. And because they idealized law, they were unable to change it. This was this inability to change law and to hold on to a fixed custom is what defined these societies. Mayne had an interesting critique of John Austin and of Austin's account of law as command, positive, sovereignty as positive command. Mayne argued that really sovereignty could not be understood as just command. Men, and that's the language that they spoke then, men obey a great mass of rules not because they are commanded, but because they understand these rules as part of convention, as custom. Mayne contrasted the most tyrannical of Indian rulers, like Raja Ranjit Singh in Punjab, with Western rulers, and he argued that Ranjit Singh made commands, but never a law. His subjects did not live by the commands he made. His subjects lived by custom administered by village tribunals. He argued that absolute rulers in the East, they tax, but they don't legislate. And Austin, in thinking of sovereignty and law as command, had actually abstracted from an entire history and that history was the history of the emancipation of custom for culture and the development of civil law. So Mayne's critique boiled down to the point that the problem was that Britain had replaced custom by legislation in India. And if you replace custom by legislation, then you make it obvious to everybody concerned that they are being ruled by an external, a coercive foreign power. India, he said, had always been ruled by custom, never by a sovereign. The solution would be to move back from rule by legislation to rule by custom. Good governance is local, decentralized, customary governance. I trace this shift in the first part of the book. As background to Queen Victoria's proclamation, immediately after the 1857 uprising. And I want to read part of that proclamation. Here's what Queen Victoria, the heart of the proclamation was a doctrine of non-interference in the private domain, especially in religion. And the Queen said, "We declare it our royal will and pleasure that none be in any wise favored, none molested or disquieted by reason of their religious faith or observances, but that all shall alike enjoy the equal and impartial protection of the law. And we do strictly charge to enjoin all those who may be in authority under us that they abstain from all interference with the religious belief or worship of any of our subjects on pain of our highest displeasure." I argue that the doctrine of interference, non-interference, actually turned into a charter for all-round interference for one reason. The occupying power gave itself the prerogative to define the boundaries of that in which it will not interfere, and then to define the content of the authentic religion with which there was to be no interference, and finally to acknowledge the authentic authority that would define and safeguard religion in its pure form without external interference. So it gave itself the right to define the authentic religious authority, the authentic religion, and the boundaries of that religion. There are scholars here, Talal Asad in particular, who has written with great erudition and insight into this question of religion. My purpose was to basically point out that this was a political project. It was a political project to define allies of custom and to define custom itself, and to define a platform for the defense of that custom and thereby the defense of those allies in order to stabilize colonial rule. I then argue how the language of colonial power moved from one of non-interference to one of protection. Protection either from the effects of the market or protection of minorities, at first Muslims, as in the first Bengal partition of early 20th century, then of Sikhs, different minorities. The language of protection, of course, has come into its own now. It's become a central part of the language of contemporary human rights, the responsibility to protect. This language, in my view, really begins with British colonial power in the early 20th century. So this Charter of Non-Interference was actually, it masked a vast ambition. And this vast ambition was to renegotiate the boundary, the authority, and the subjectivity of those who were to be ruled. I argue in the book that what distinguished British colonialism from all previous colonial powers, including Roman imperialism, Roman Empire, what distinguished it was that all previous powers had sought to rule through native elites, either in a pact or through a simulation. Roman ambition in terms of a Roman citizenship was basically directed at colonized elites. Roman citizens in the West were basically Roman soldiers and colonies of Roman soldiers. In the East, Rome integrated entire communities, not individuals. Individual citizenship was basically extended to magistrates. What distinguished British colonial power was that it sought to shape the subjectivity not of the elite. That was the project under direct rule. That was the project of the civilizing mission. What changed after 1857 was that a massively ambitious project unfolded. The objective now was to shape the subjectivity of ordinary people, to define custom. Not out of thin air, not just to invent it, as has been argued by some people, but to actually sift through a history, to sift through a history in order to identify the most authoritarian elements in that history, to separate the authoritarian from the emancipatory, and to build a notion of custom on an authoritarian legacy, to identify allies who had legitimacy but had little power, who were under threat of displacement by new forces. And to do this in a language of inclusion. The construction of this custom and customary rule was at the same time the construction of a regime of difference. So I want to give you an example. In the book, I discuss India, and I discuss very briefly the Malay states, and I discuss Aceh and the Dutch Islamist Hargonje, who is brought to Aceh to sort of advise on how to put down an insurgency which has been going on for almost two decades, and who arrives at more or less an answer similar to that of Maine. But then the most of the book is about it's about Africa, especially parts of Africa colonized late 19th, early 20th century. So I ask the reader to I ask you to think of if you think of census, you know, I think a census gives us, you know, if an economist wants a description of income distribution, equality, inequality, they go to national income figures on a single page. You can get a listing of groups by income. If you're interested in how people are governed, a census is a good starting point. If you look at the census of most African countries, 20th century, in the colonial period, you will find that the population is classified under two headings. One is called races, and the other is called tribe. Nobody is put under both. You either are classified as a race, as belonging to a race, or as belonging to a tribe. And when you read it and you ask yourself, who gets classified as a race and who gets classified as a tribe, of course the first impulse is to think that maybe race is colonizers and tribe is colonized, but that's actually not the case. Number of colonized classified under race, usually those who came as immigrants from outside, people like me, people of Asian origin, or those who are classified by the state as not indigenous, people like coloreds in South Africa, people like Tutsi in Rwanda. So your first realization is that the distinction between race and tribe is really not that between colonizer and colonized, it's between native and non-native. Natives are classified under tribes, and non-natives are classified under race. So the second question, I'm basically trying to describe how Maine influenced a new kind of statecraft. Okay. So the second question which arises is, well, what difference does it make whether you get defined as belonging to a race or a tribe? The difference it makes, it decides the law under which you will have to live. Because all races lived under civil law. And all tribes lived under customary law. Civil law was a single law for all races, whether you were from Europe or Asia or Arab. Arab was a race, or colored, or Tutsi. You all lived under a single law, which had internal discrimination based on race, but a single legal structure. Tribes lived under separate customary laws. So you ask yourself, why? The answer was that this legal pluralism was meant to respect difference. But then you ask yourself that the races came from all parts of the world. They spoke mutually unintelligible languages. They had different historical archives, even different cultural definitions, different religious affiliations. And yet they were ruled under the same law. Tribes were neighbors, right? Languages belonged to a single family, usually. You could hear one another, as the expression goes. There was a shared history, not the same history, but a shared history. And yet tribes were ruled under separate customary laws. So the answer was not really culture, the answer was political. It was political in the sense that if you live under a single law, you're meant to have a common destiny. If you live under separate laws, you're supposed to have separate destinies. The two legal systems were entirely different in orientation. They corresponded to Mayne's notion of the difference between civil law and custom. Civil law, in fact, was very much like English common law, which you would think is custom, but it was not custom as defined in the colonies. English common law changes with circumstances. English common law gives you different vantage points, different perspectives, different interests. But customary law in the colonies was not supposed to change. Any change was considered a corruption. The definition of custom was that which was purest, which existed at the beginning. In this sense, actually, if you think of the contemporary notion of fundamentalism as something which traces its essence to the beginning and then uses force to compel its observance, that actually happened. That was the construction of customary law under colonial power. My argument is that we know colonialism as the hotbed of racism. Right? We know it as a time when the majority of the population, the conquered, colonized population, was distinguished by race and disprivileged. But I think that's half the story. And actually, that's the part of the story which has had the most problems surviving independence. There's another part of the story, which stems from the fact that colonialism was actually based on two different axes of discrimination. One was the axis that divided natives from non-natives, race. The other was a form of discrimination based on what was called tribe, which separated one group of natives from another group of natives on the basis of a separate homeland and a separate customary law and a separate customary authority. The first project, the moment a colony was stabilized, the first project was always massive ethnic cleansing to get everybody to move to their rightful place, their tribal homeland. The second project was to institute a native authority in the native homeland. And the native authority was supposed to be a custodian of customary rights. And customary rights were about two things. One, about land. The right to land belonged not to everybody who lived in the area, but only to those who came from the area. And the second was the right to participate in governance. The right to participate in governance, meaning the right to be appointed a sub-chief or a chief or a village chief or a district chief, also belonged to only those who came from there. Everywhere, the population was multi-ethnic, but everywhere, customary rights became the rights of only those from the land. It was a legal setup which was bound to trigger in time conflict between ethnic groups. who lived in the same territory. I don't want to go on for too long. There is, after all, the book. So the rest of the book is actually a third of the book discusses two different kinds of responses to this colonial statecraft, which comes into being post-1857 India, but really comes into full force in early 20th century Africa. So the last third of the book traces two responses. It traces an intellectual response to the kind of historiography that followed Henry Maine's propositions. And I trace a single historian, Yusuf Bala Usman, a Nigerian historian from Ahmadu Bello University. Yusuf passed away some few years ago, but I last met him in about 7 years ago in Zaria at ABU, at a time when Sharia law had been introduced in Zaria, and Yusuf, who said, "Mahmoud, let's go and have some drinks and chomo, roasted meat." I said, "But you have Sharia law here. I mean, you know, where are we going to get drinks and roasted meat?" He said, no, "The university is federal territory. Different laws operate here." So we went to the university staff club, had several beers and roasted meat, and I noticed lots of people coming in with suitcases and going out with, you know, zipped suitcases but pointing in different directions, kind of, you know. Bottles are big, you know, glass bottles. They're not cans. We had a nice evening. So I think of Yusuf Bala Usman as a historian ahead of his times, you know. And the second response that I discuss is not an intellectual response as much as a response in statecraft, and that's about Mwalimu Julius Nyerere in mainland Tanzania. And it is about Nyerere has been understood basically as the author of Ujamaa and as a sort of idealistic intellectual who strayed into power and made a mess of it by trying to build Ujamaa. But I argue that really Nyerere's project was very different. It was basically to create a nation state, to decolonize the state. And Nyerere's greatness was to recognize that at the heart of colonial power lay not the force of violence, but really a legal administrative system it had brought, which survived the colonial power. And unless that project was dismantled, this project of civil law and different customary authorities, each in its own tribal homeland. And I put forth a different kind of narrative which seeks to explain what he did and didn't do as an outcome, as a pursuit, as a successful pursuit of this particular project. And I argue that really the hallmark of Nyerere's success is that if you look at that part of Africa, Eastern Central Africa, you will find that in every country except mainland Tanzania, you have had one kind of either ethnic cleansing or ethnic killing, and that it was actually the dismantling of a legal administrative apparatus which politicized a ethnic difference and generated a conflict, ethnic conflict. It was that dismantling which was the real explanation of this fact. So I thank you.
Hello. But I told Badmini a little while ago, before we came here to this room, that I came here to listen to Mamdani and not to talk about his book. But now, let me say a few things about the book, which perhaps sometimes would overlap with what Mahmoud talked about. The book, and I've been reading the book for the last 2 weeks, actually, and it's really an amazing book. You look at the book and you sort of really see, and Mahmoud himself mentions in the last paragraph of the book, that this is a small book, but that's really a mis sort of characterization of the book, in the sense that what you have here is a book that has depth and breadth, and a book that really, it takes you so much to sort of digest and understand what the book is about. The inspiration, Mahmoud writes, for these lectures came from two sources. The first, from a reading of W.E.B. Du Bois' book, The World and Africa, in 2007. Here, Professor Mamdani Mahmoud underlines the importance of Du Bois' title. Africa, in other words, in that title, The World and Africa, is given a voice. It becomes its own agency. In other words, the conjunctive here, and, is not only a cabula that connects the world to Africa, but it also functions as an antidote to earlier misperceptions of Africa as a barren, uncivilized, and mute place. As Mamdani explains, this meant, quote, writing about the world from an African vantage point, unquote. The second impetus for writing this book, the book, came from a question Professor Andres Eshit, who was then the Vice Chancellor at Addis Ababa University in Ethiopia, and who was not long ago, he still is actually, a minister at the Prime Minister's office in Ethiopia, where Andres Eshit, following a lecture Mahmoud gave on British indirect rule, asked Mahmoud, quote, how, he asked it, is this different from previous empires, unquote. Mamdani was not impressed, Mahmoud was not impressed with his response to Ashit's question, that he, quote, left with a distinct feeling to give serious and further thought to this question, unquote. And that serious thought produced this book. And in that sense, we should really thank Professor Eshit for asking that question. The focus of the book is to trace the history and locus of the indirect rule state, which Mahmoud Mamdani understands as, quote, a quintessential modern form of rule in a colonial setting, unquote. He clearly demonstrates how indirect rule differed from, quote, modes of rule in previous Western empires, including Roman and British direct rule before mid-19th century and French assimilation before the early 20th century turn to association. The differences, unquote, the differences are revealed in two important ways. Previous empires put a premium on, quote, conquered elites rather than the mass of the colonized, unquote. They aimed, in other words, quote, to eradicate differences through a policy of cultural and sometimes political assimilation of colonized elites, unquote. Indirect rule, on the contrary, not only acknowledged difference, but it also shaped. The operative word here is shaped, which is Mahmoud's word, not mine. Mamdani shows the pitfalls associated with managing differences, in the sense that how do you ensure that the jinn, the devil, does not create or engender uncontrollable convulsions once you have tried to manage differences. Mahmoud argues that it is under indirect rule, colonialism, that the definition of management, quote, of difference, was developed as the essence of governance. The difference between the modern democratic state and its colonial version is this, he says, quote, the modern state ensures equal citizenship in political society while acknowledging difference in civil society, but its colonial counterpart institutionalized difference in both the polity and society, end quote. In other words, in the colonial indirect rule state then, citizenship, Mahmoud argues, was, quote, in the exclusive domain of the settler. In other words, to sustain the settler's raison d'etre, for example, the category native was created as a political identity. The dichotomy revealed the inefficacy of existing colonial policies. But this also depicted an empire, as Mahmoud says, in crisis. It is here where intellectualists came to the rescue. You heard Mahmoud talking about Henry Maine. And Henry Maine, this Oxbridge sort of kind of guy, who in a way sort of looked, especially at the sepoy mutiny in India in 1857. And people were here saying, how did this really happen? And Maine said, I know why. It is because we sort of really focused on the colonized elites instead of sort of the mass sort of the Indian majority. In other words, he said, we should not really have focused on the Sanskrit texts, for example. We should not have over-relied on the Brahminic sort of codes, but we should have focused on the hinterlands, in other words, as opposed basically to the urbanized cosmopolitan coast. And here then he came up with this idea to get out of this sticking point. He was saying we have to rethink, as Mahmoud calls it, the technology that sort of undergirds governance, the colonial sort of governance. Here, Mahmoud shows the sort of ruses used to marginalize the so-called native. The designation does not connote or denote, quote, a condition that's original and authentic. And therein lies the irony that he talks about. The native is called the native, not to suggest, denote, or connote that that is original or authentic. Under indirect rule, native authority assumed the governance of the native. This authority, as Mahmoud said a little while ago, claimed to be faithful to tradition and custom. Land and governance fell under the rubric of native authority. Homelands were created, and each home became the designated place of a native tribe. But colonial privilege, though, mimicked the policies that promulgated differences in the first place, racial and tribal, as Mahmoud talked about. Now, later in the book, in the case of Mwalimu Julius Nyerere, the father of that nation we call today Tanzania, anti-colonial nationalism, Mahmoud writes, was, quote, the antidote of enforced difference. It underlined, in other words, he says, our common humanity. When it came to the nationalist project, however, there was no agreement, end quote. Some, he says, wanted to turn the erstwhile world of the binary upside down. Others wanted to create a new world, one that would do away with the old political identities. Quote, Mahmoud says, the only emancipation possible for settler and native is for both to cease to exist as political identities, unquote. Something here, when I was reading this part, I was really reminded of Raymond Williams' novel, The Second Generation. Most of the times we forget that Williams was a novelist. But in Second Generation, he talks about, especially Africa he was talking about, what he says, the person, quote unquote, a tribalist or a clan sort of minded, must own his clan mindedness, but make sure that they give it up and go through and emerge the other side. Or here, what it seemed to me, this would help them to transcend, in other words, what the Guyanese writer Wilson Harris calls victim stasis and victory stasis, and thus the need to really transcend those stasis. To make his arguments cogent, Mahmoud goes to the source in determining the scope and intellectual origins of the phenomenon under his perusal. He frets out primary evidence, and this is where really the book comes, assumes a mantle in the sense that Mahmoud goes to the source. Here, as we said before, and as he talked about, the focus is on Henry Maine, who it seems, as we said before, came to the rescue of an empire in crisis. The first chapter, of course, I won't be saying more, you will have to read yourselves, but the first chapter contextualizes the need for, quote, a new form of colonial governmentality, which Mahmoud borrows from Foucault, as you know. Henry Maine is the main focus of this chapter. Quote, through a theory of history and a theory of law, Maine creates binaries that separates the West from the non-West, and a universal civilization from local custom. In the process, Mahmoud says, he distinguishes, that is, Maine distinguishes the settler from the native. I will skip parts in the interest of time, and we will have enough time perhaps later on to ask questions and for me to also ask some questions. Here, the second part of that chapter focuses, as Mahmoud said, the Malay. And here again, It is the British colonial sort of powers trying to, in a way, distinguish from what they called native and Asli, for example, original, authentic sort of natives. And in the case of Indonesia, what the Dutch did in Aceh, in Indonesia. He also talks about the second chapter, which is called Nativism, the Practice. The first chapter basically was Nativism, the Theory. And this theory was put forward, as he mentioned, Maine and other intellectuals in the West. The second chapter then talks about Nativism, the Practice, how that theory was now put into practice. And he talks about the case of the Sudan, and there is no need to sort of really go back to what Mahmoud said, but the Mahdiya and its pan-Sudanese agenda. But here is where it becomes really important to understand. The Mahdiya basically was a pan-Sudanese movement, in the true sense of the word. All tribes, in other words, could sort of really find themselves signified in its national idiom, basically. What the British did then, it used tribalism to defeat the Mahdiya. Chapter 3 talks about, it's titled Beyond Settlers and Natives, the Theory and Practice of Colonization. Here again, Mahmoud uses the intellectual critiques of Yusuf Bala Usman and also Kenneth Dike and also Abdullahi Smith, all from Nigeria, in which they talk about the idea of how colonialism really created narratives, but not only created narratives, but denied historicity and history to the so-called natives. The last part of the book, which is the second part of the last chapter, is on Mwalimu Julius Nyerere that Mahmoud talked about. And of course, Julius Nyerere, as you know, was the father of that nation, as we said before, of Tanzania, but before that, of Tanganyika. Now, this is an intellectual, a formidable intellectual, who even before he became the prime minister of Tanganyika, translated two of Shakespeare's plays, Merchant of Venice and Julius Caesar. And therein lies the importance of this of Mwalimu Nyerere. But I'll stop here, and I will sort of ask Mahmoud some questions to start with, and I will make sure. There is a Somali proverb that says, those who are next or standing next to the pot, the cooking pot, always take the best parts, the juicy part. I will make sure that that won't happen. I will ask him only three questions, and then you will have enough time to ask. Thank you. I'll start with that last part, Mwalimu Nyerere, and the idea of Ujama and that whole, really, the way he decolonized it, as you mentioned in the book. But there's a place that you say it was not like the Leninist sort of thing of smashing the state. And yet, Mualimu, if you sort of think about, especially in terms of the aborted coup, you would sort of really assume that he uses some kind of violence. In the sense, even though that sort of violence to me was a kind of redemptive and not a delinquent one. Does that make sense to
you? Sure.
Yeah.
Well, Mualimu was not averse at all to use violence in the interest of stabilizing power. I don't think to just stabilize his own position. There were two major instances of use of violence. The first, the one you've mentioned, was the use of violence after the mutiny, 1964, and the arrest of number of opposition leaders, and particularly the arrest of leaders of the African National Congress. The African National Congress opposed TANU and Mualimu from the left. The African National Congress argued that the Tanzanian citizenship must be defined as the citizen, as a prerogative of the native. It must not be a citizenship based on residence. It must not be a citizenship based on simply the legal fact of having been born in the country, but actually should be based on descent. In other words, the Tanzanian African National Congress basically wanted to turn the world, the colonial world, upside down, but without changing its logic. It saw the world as a world of native and non-native. And it also demanded that it's the native who should have priority in education, employment, state employment in particular. It demanded what is called now an affirmative action program, but a permanent affirmative action program for natives. Mualimu's response to it is very interesting. I think his response to it is twofold. One, to disagree in principle, to disagree that there should be group rights and group limitations. So, as a classic liberal, in a sense, to stand up for rights as rights of individuals, and to identify colonialism as a system which created group rights and group limitations. That was first. But the second response in practice was, one, to arrest the leaders of this movement, but two, to adopt their political program. In other words, to adopt the affirmative action program, which he did. Because I think over time there was an understanding that if injustice had been racialized, in some ways justice would have to be racialized. The big debate was about whether this would be a permanent feature of the nature of the state itself, or whether it would be a temporary policy measure. The second case where Molly Mounier used violence, I think, was far more serious. And that was when the policy of Ujamaa, Ujamaa Vijijini, sort of village-based socialism, as you would explain it, collectivization of villages, when this policy was adopted, in the first phase, it was basically meant to be a result of persuasion. And it wasn't particularly persuasive. No more than 8 or 9% of peasants or villages became Ujamaa villages. And in the next phase, you had the use of massive force to force peasants into villages. The goal of collectivization was dropped, but it became like any developmental measure, just a goal of bringing people together to herd them together, in a sense, into concentrated communities, so that they could be governed. And the reason given was often that so that roads could be built or electricity could be brought, etc. So basically, in the book, I argue that you had to look beyond this to see what it is that he accomplished. And to look beyond this, you had to see the ways in which the administrative legal inheritance from the colonial period was radically and dramatically reformed.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say, because when we look in East Africa, as you know, and you say this, this is the most stable sort of really place to a certain extent. Early introduction of Kiswahili, the language, Ujamaa that you're talking about, and the role of education. What was the role of education in sort of creating a cohesive sort of nation, call it Tanganyika, Tanzania?
I don't think this is a subtle question.
Yeah.
And for the following reason. There's been a big debate on education, particularly language. Here you have Ngugi wa Thiong'o, the Kenyan writer, who announced at one point that he would stop writing in English and he would write only in Kiswahili, or in Kikuyu. Sort of the two sides of the debate. One side of the debate has spoken in terms of sort of cultural terms. What is our own culture? What are our own languages? And decolonization means going back to our own languages. And the other side of the debate has spoken in functional terms, that since there is no single language within the country, and since this is the language of the intelligentsia, then we should be speaking in terms of English or French or Portuguese, whatever. It also gives us international access, etc. This is very much in developmentalist, functionalist terms. And of course, the irony is this, that I remember being told. The irony is this, that if you look at some of the most rapidly developing countries in the world today, from China on, these are all countries which use their own language, historically their own language, in a sense, And probably African countries, I would say the non-Arabic speaking African countries are probably the only countries where the intelligentsia speaks a different language from what the people speak. So the result has been, in a way, the creation of a linguistic apartheid within the country. It means that most common people cannot access public affairs in formally public institutions like parliament, courts. They cannot access high culture. They cannot access higher education. Now, in Tanzania, there was kind of a halfway house. Kiswahili was... I taught at the University of Dar es Salaam, 73 to 79. It was my first job. And my parents are both born in Tanzania, and my grandparents, some of them are born in Tanzania or Kenya. And anyway, so... Tanzania was like a halfway house because primary and secondary education in state schools was in Kiswahili. English was taught as a foreign language. Then you came to the university. At the university, English became the medium of instruction. And there was an institute of Kiswahili studies. So Kiswahili was like a foreign language in the university. English was the... now what has happened, and of course you would have the crisis of when you got students coming from private schools into the university, they spoke fluent English. And when the students came from state schools into the university, they spoke, you know, not great English. And it showed in their results because... the lectures were only in English. The exams had to be in English, etc. So now what has happened is that instead of the university becoming a Kiswahili, the schools have adopted, secondary schools have adopted English as the medium of instruction. And I have no doubt that with the schools for the wealthy, it will soon be primary schools also adopting English. So this question remains a troubled issue, and I think it's bound to be an important question as we go on. I remember 1994, we had a CODESRIA meeting in Algiers, and this is the time when FIS, the sort of Islamist party, was about to contend elections, and the intelligentsia was outraged, alarmed. And it became clear to me that the main reason for this outrage was that FIS was going to change university education from French to Arabic, and they would lose their jobs because they wouldn't be able. They didn't have the facility to teach in Arabic. They had the facility to converse in Arabic on the street, etc., but not. So the real issues connected with real interests. But they weren't about religion, they were about language. Right? Really.
In fact, I forgot about Gubi and the rest. In talking about language, but what sort of really interested me, in the book especially, the way you connected what was going on in Aceh, for example, in Indonesia, especially when you talk about Bahasa Indonesia, the language, and what Sukarno came up with, that idea of guided democracy. And I was sort of really saying, here you have Sukarno and Mwalimu. And when you compare the two nations, the two countries now, you sort of really see that perhaps Mwalimu's idea was far advanced perhaps than Ahmed Sukarno perhaps. It's my...
I'll take that as a statement.
Yeah, it is. It is. Let me sort of... the title is Define and Rule. And most of the times people sort of really think about divide and rule. And you talk about this in the book, and you talk about if I were to ask you, which in fact I'm asking you, what's the difference?
Well, the difference is the following. I think when the Romans thought of divide and rule, they thought of it like a chess game with set pieces. So the identity of the pieces is given, and then you bring them together or divide them. The new thing about British indirect rule was that identity was no longer a given, that the whole point of colonial rule was to shape and reshape subjectivities, popular subjectivities. Was the whole point of colonial rule was to take command of what they call custom, thereby redefine identity. So that's why I called it Define and Rule. I mean, it was an attractive title too. I thought easy to remember.
It is. If there's one thing that I take away with me, is this injunction, historicize, historicize, historicize. And history, and you talk about this when you talk about Bala Usman, and also Abdullah Smith and Kenneth Dickey. History in the sense, and I assume you would agree with me, that history is the reconstruction of past events in the historian's mind. And therein lies the problem and the problematic of sort of really history in the sense of a finding and a making at the same time. What do you think, what do you make of especially Bala Usman's contribution to this rewriting and historicizing the African past?
I mean, I think Bala Usman was very conscious of this dilemma. I mean, he, in fact, this dilemma was at the core of his thinking. He was very conscious of the fact, and he says it, I quote him extensively, he says that history is written from the vantage point of the present, and the point of the history you write is that you have a problem in mind, and that problem is in the present. It's not somewhere else. So you are a part of this present, inescapably. You are a part of this present. You are not outside of history. You are right there, within it. You are inside that which you construct. So there's this whole problem of objectivity. And he says the only way to tackle this problem of objectivity is first to become conscious of it, is to move away from the pretense, the illusion that you're outside of it, that you're God, that you're not God. You're human, and you're right inside it. Third issue he raises is that the categories through which you are constructing this past are all categories forged in the present. So that you are kind of constructing a past which you're presentifying the past, in a way. So he sets out these problems, and then what he does is, he says, he gives you a critique of a number of colonial historians, starting with Frederick Barth, the German scholar, explorer, and on to many others. And he said that all of them, they came with fixed categories, and the category was race and tribe. And they wrote historical narratives based on race and tribe, and they looked for racial difference. They looked for the Hausa racially distinct from the Fulani, and he said, my project is different. And in a way, he first deconstructs it. In a sense, he doesn't use that language, but he deconstructs it. And the way he deconstructs it is that he shows that you could actually look at tensions amongst the Hausa, You could look at tensions amongst the town-based Hausa and the rural Hausa. You could look at the tensions between the pastoral Fulani and the ruling Fulani, and you would come up with a different sense of how developments moved and took place. And then he goes to construct. And his construction is basically, he says, I'm interested in the question of how are we going to build a state? How are we going to build a state given this legacy of British colonialism? And his answer is that actually the political community has a longer history than the British acknowledged. The British only acknowledged colonial era as a much longer history. And so he proceeds to construct, to narrativize that history of political community, the history of state formation. So that's what his work was basically, and to show that the changes take place are better understood on the basis of a criterion like residence rather than a criterion like race or tribe. Mm.
As I said before, I'm not going to take all the best juicy parts out of Mahmoud. The last sort of question for me is, again, talking about Bala and the rest of them. There is a place where Aimé Césaire sort of really says, I am off before Adam, in the sense that I really predate the sort of parameters within which discussion could really take place. And the worry, or history in the sense of the pre-colonial, say, for example, how do we go through what was given to us, or round it, perhaps around it, and go to what was really, if at all there is such a thing, as the pre-colonial? How do we go about resuscitating, reviving, going back to the source, as Amilcar Cabral would say, when in fact it's the source itself is not the same, nor the returnee is the same?
Well, there are people who tried to do that. There was Du Bois in Africa and the World who actually was the first to kind of go to Egypt and Ethiopia as the source. There was Sheikh Anta Diop, who was a student in Paris when Du Bois was writing this, but who never acknowledged Du Bois. And he created a really nationalist intellectual project, which in my view basically gave a de-racialized version of colonial history. Because colonial history was always that Africa was civilized from up north, coming down south. The Hamitic hypothesis, yes. Right? Hamites came from the north down south, and Sheikh Anta Diop gives us the Hamitic hypothesis, except the Hamites are Negro. They come also from Egypt and civilize. So the critics, some of the critics speak of this as a Nilocentric, it's just sort of thing of Africa as whatever lies along the Nile. And I think there is some substance to it also, because personally I am more and more critical of the notion that sees writes a history of Africa, which goes all the way back to Egypt or whatever, because I think that it's difficult to think of Africa before Atlantic slavery. I think that the notion of Africa is very much a product of that intensified slave experience of enslavement. I think before it, one has to think of regions. So that pre-Vasco da Gama, I think East Africa is much better understood as part of the Indian Ocean region. I think the Congo Basin is better understood as a region. I think West Africa and the West and North Africa as region around the Sahara and the Mediterranean, and I think, you know, so on and so forth. I mean, so I don't mean by historicizing that we eternalize whatever categories we are using today. I think we historicize the categories too. There is the question that Bala Usman asked, to which I suspect there is no single and satisfactory answer, which is that we are part of that which we write about. So that we are. I'd love to hear your response to this.
We are implicated in whatever we write.
We're implicated in what we do.
But one last sort of question, which personal, basically.
You already asked me two last questions.
I know. But you are talking to the Somalis. You're talking to a Somali, Ahmed. That last one. Why did you forget to throw the Somalis in the mix?
Can you imagine if I'd written about the Somalis and have you as discussant? You would have roasted me. I didn't. I didn't forget. I had no ambition to write about everything. I had an argument to make. Whatever I wrote about helped me make the argument, and so it was taken from wherever I had studied and whatever I had studied, in a sense. It's no attempt to write an encyclopedic like any part of Africa. You turn to the index, you'll find yourself there, and then you find something in the text. No, it's not there. So it's a modest book. When I have vast ambitions, I write about Somalia.
One last question. I'm kidding. Well, yes.
I'm kidding. The audience, we have about 10, 15 minutes for discussion. If anybody wants to, there's a microphone there.
I hope you will not think this unfair, but I mean, I think you always bring a powerful analysis to real important worldly questions. And I wonder if you would apply your understanding of what Nyerere did to Syria, and whether or not you would say your understanding of the new colonialism of Britain somehow teaches us something to understand about that country and its troubles.
I haven't written a book on Syria. Look, it's an important question to which I would like to hear an answer also. But I don't have an answer. Not an answer I can give publicly, no.
Go ahead, sir.
All right. You'll probably have the same response to my question. I just wanted to throw out there, if the head of a given African state came to you and asked for advice as to how to reconfigure the administration of the state, the legal institutions of the state, going forward, and you can pick a particular African country if you like, what would you say?
Nobody has asked me. I mean, look, you know, this balance between a common citizenship and a cultural difference, okay, this relationship is kind of the nut to crack. I'm thinking of Uganda, you know, or similar contexts. I have been a proponent, sort of weighing on the side of common citizenship for a long time. And yet I noticed that over the years, well, I was a proponent of the unitary state, and I'm gradually moving on to a position of a federal structure. But I am very critical of federal structures, like in Nigeria, for example, what came out of the Civil War. I'm very critical of the federal character principle. In Nigeria, the constitution that came out of the Civil War says that key federal institutions must reflect a federal character, and the key federal institutions are the civil service, the army, and the federal universities. And to reflect federal character means that recruitment in these institutions should be based on ratios which reflect the proportion of the population in each state in Nigeria, and that's fine. But then comes the problematic next step, which is that who can qualify, who can compete for these positions, and the answer is only those indigenous to the state. And then you ask, who is indigenous to the state? Then the answer is only somebody born of a father born in that state, right? So this disqualifies the most dynamic sections of the population, whether they are workers who have moved and got jobs somewhere else, or landless peasants who have moved, or traders and merchants and craftsmen who have moved, or industrialists who have moved, or intellectuals who have moved, whatever. But increasingly, you know, I think that we have created in the African context a version of federalism which has put the colonial logic on a pedestal, because it's not a federalism based on territorial affiliation. It's a federalism based on group definition, based on descent. And that's hugely problematic. So if this person who invited me was from Nigeria, I would say that. That the first thing is to think of an alternative to federal character. It's, you know, in many African countries we have, let me give you a second example. If you take Kenya, take the violence in Kenya, okay, the Rift Valley, violence in the Rift Valley. And this violence is, even though they've got the International Criminal Court putting six people, taking them to trial, the real cause of the violence is the land question, on which politicians feed. But and the land question in the Rift Valley is that the British solution to the end of Mau Mau uprising was to give large amounts of land to those who collaborated with the British on the highlands, and to resettle the Mau Mau in the Rift Valley, and to displace poor peasants in the Rift Valley. Now, you have two sets of demands for land in the Rift Valley, each based on a different notion of rights. One group says those who were displaced in the Rift Valley, the poor peasants who were displaced, say this is our tribal land. They are demanding rights based on British colonial system. The other group, the Mau Mau who were brought down from the highlands and who got the land down there, they are basing their rights on a post-colonial logic. We are Kenyans and we have rights to land here, right? And our rights are market-based in a sense. I mean, we have real issues. It was the same question in Darfur. If you looked at that conflict around land between those who came down from the north and those who were the peasants around Jabal Mara, said this is our tribal homeland. You can't come here. The other guy is saying, no, we are as Sudanese as you are. There's the drought. We have no way of making a living. We're here. This, the Middle Belt, Nigeria. I mean, I think we have quite often we have a conflict of right against right, and there's no single solution. There's no magical solution. That's what I mean.
There are three people standing, so I'd like to take the last three questions, and then we can wrap up. So let's go over here.
Thank you for always illuminating presentation. I was curious, this is maybe a little bit far afield, but I was curious if you had encountered in the materials any, in the British colonialist materials, any references to the situation of American Indians, Native Americans, and legal precedents and categorizations that always seemed to me very neglected in questions of race and colonialism, and whether there had been any attention paid that you had, you know, encountered.
Maybe we can go over here and get the two more questions.
I just wanted to ask about Tanzania today and kind of, I mean, you already talked about the present and in looking at history and how it follows you, whether kind of the reassessment of Nyerere is being done because of what's going on in Tanzania today, and if it should, if your text should be read in that context, and how these issues are playing out in contemporary Tanzania.
Last question.
It's just a clarifying question, maybe. You define, I mean, you describe and define and rule the new set of, new kind of colonial governmentality that emerges. And I'm just thinking, is it only within the British colonial response to the crises in the late 19th century? Or if it's not the define and rule kind of colonialism, how does it sort of, get replicated in other colonial rules? So that's
okay. It's all yours.
Yeah, thank you. Well, Native Americans. I remember doing work in the archives in South Africa, and period before 1910. Okay, 1910 is when. The South African government set up native reserves, and they, you know, declared, I think, 87% of the land as white land and 13% of the land as native land. So before they did this, they sent a delegation to North America to study how to do it, because. It was first done here, which is the reservations. Okay, from 1850 onwards, the California reservations, and then, of course, Lincoln stepped up, putting Indians in concentration camps, basically, with the Civil War. And then after the Civil War, and I became convinced, and I intend to write something about it, that if you look at settler colonialism, all key institutions of settler colonialism were devised in North America. They were devised in North America and exported from here. And the key institutions are creating a native homeland, the reservation itself, right? Creating a native authority, which is completely undemocratic, based on a very authoritarian version of native custom, almost totally dependent on an external, the external power which backs it up, and creating a separate law for each native group, defined now as a tribe. And I define tribe. I don't in the book. I don't define tribe as a cultural group. I define it as an administrative entity. That's what really they meant by a tribe, an administrative entity. So even the pass system, right? Passes are invented in North America. They are invented in response to resistance I believe it is first in the Apache camps that the passes are first invented. I'm not entirely sure, but it's also in Canada. Passes are it's a North American contribution, and of course it in this country, you know, the quintessential defining experience is said to be slavery. But I think history has shown that the quintessential defining experience was that of the genocide of Native Americans. And this is one thing the U.S. has not been able to come to terms with. It's even been unable to acknowledge it, even to face it. So it intrigues me. It intrigues me that American political theorists, when they write about the U.S., they follow de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, as what is different about the U.S. is that it did not have a feudal past, but never addressing what it had was a genocide. That's the founding moment. That's the founding moment of the U.S. It's not the absence of, because the whole of social theory has been rotating around this notion of absence of, you know, you're underdeveloped, you don't have this, you're underdeveloped, you're pre-industrial, you don't have this, you are pre-that. So, you know, if I'm to look at a student and say you are pre-professor, you know, like, that's your destiny, to be a professor, you know, and you are not yet there, you know, sort of. Is how do you understand something by understanding what it is not? I mean, you've skipped the whole question of what it is, you know, and its own historicity. I've come back to this question. Yeah. So, the reassessment of Nyerere, yes. Well, look, there's a big, Issa Shivji led this land commission, how many years ago? 15-20 years ago, and really the big debate on land rights sort of who land rights and market rights, and this is the big debate around the whole of East Africa. You have the neoliberal project with its claim that you must have freehold tenure in land, and that's the only way to develop. And then you have the others, who I think are closer to reality, which is that freehold tenure is a step closer to dispossession of the tiller rather than, you know, any kind of development. Or but you have a debate around land. You have a debate around the neoliberal project itself, and that's at the heart of the reassessment of Nyerere in a way. And you have a debate around this question of cultural difference and political rights, ethnicity. The last question, in this small book, I've written. Mainly about the British transition from direct to indirect rule, but also about the Dutch, which was a parallel transition. The French, the French really was almost part of a self-definition of, the French, the Laïcité project and everything that, was about the civilizing mission. And the French had several knocks. I mean, they learned in Morocco. Morocco is where they first... The French moved from assimilation to association roughly in the sort of 1930s. The French learned in Senegal that you actually could form alliances with the Marabout, the Sufi leaders of Sufi brotherhoods, and the four communes became sort of history. The four communes whose inhabitants had French citizenship became history, and the rest of Senegal became a protectorate, ruled under customary law and native authorities. And so that very soon the difference between French and British colonialism was the difference between Jean and John. Not much, just how you pronounced it. But they all came to it through their, because they were all faced with the same political dilemma, which is, how do you control the native? And they all reached the same solution, which is to fragment as much as possible, based on a discourse of authenticity. And culture and custom, and not necessarily unreal, real, but politicize it, make it the basis of difference in the political sphere. Thank you.
With that, I think we have to close it here. There are copies of the book outside, I think, for sale, and maybe Professor Mamdani will sign one if you are very nice to him. And I want to thank both. Professor Ahmed and Professor Mamdani for a very, very interesting conversation. So thank you very much.